I don't always listen to podcasts, but when I do, I listen to STEM Talk, interviewing the most interesting people in the world of science and technology. Stay curious, my friends.
Welcome to STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM
STEM
Talk.
STEM Talk.
Welcome to STEM Talk, where we introduce you to fascinating people who passionately inhabit the scientific and technical frontiers of our society. I'm your host, Dawn Kernagas, and today we have Dr. Rhonda Patrick. She is an American biochemist, a cell biologist, a science communicator, and a podcaster. We also have joining us today IHMC's director, Dr. Ken Ford.
Hi, Dawn. This should be a fascinating and fun interview.
Rhonda has her bachelor's degree from UCSD in biochemistry, and she has her PhD in biomedical science from the University of Tennessee and also St. Jude's Children's Hospital. Currently, she is a postdoctoral fellow at the Children's Hospital Oakland Research Institute, where she investigates the effects of micronutrient inadequacies on metabolism, inflammation, DNA damage, and aging.
Yes, and in that role, she's really fortunate to be working with Dr. Bruce Ames, a true luminary in the field and, by all accounts, just an incredible mentor.
And she's also passionate about dispensing health-related information to the general public.
Yes. In fact, she's a regular guest on numerous podcasts, including her own podcast called Found My Fitness, and has twice lectured at IHMC. In fact, the lectures of her talks at IHMC are available on YouTube and heavily subscribed. Links to her podcast and lectures will be in the show notes.
Yeah, I'm really excited about this interview with Dr. Rhonda Patrick. She's a very good communicator and does a really good job of teaching complex concepts when it comes to nutrition and health and breaking them down for the general public to understand. So on we go with the interview.
STEM Talk.
STEM
Talk.
STEM
Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM
STEM.
Talk.
STEM Talk.
So today we have Dr. Rhonda Patrick joining us for STEM Talk. Dr. Patrick, welcome.
Thanks for having me. It's nice to meet you, Dawn.
So we're just going to get started. I'm going to ask you some questions just about your background. Tell us how you even got into research in the first place.
I kind of just stumbled into it. You know, I grew up in Southern California. I was surfing in college. I was teaching surfing in college, you know, while I was a chemistry major. So I was a chemistry major, biochemistry. I was also doing research in an organic chemistry lab. And I sort of just was interested in what I was doing, but I kind of got bored with the chemistry of it. It was like, well, after the challenge was, you know, met, then I kind of was like, what's next? And I didn't feel like any application. I wasn't feeling connected to synthesizing peptides, you know, in the lab. So I decided after I graduated from UCSD that I wanted to try biology out, you know, because I really didn't have that many biology courses, believe it or not, as a chemistry major. And so I went to work at the Salk Institute for Biological Sciences.
Pretty good place to go work.
Yeah, it was pretty exceptional. I felt pretty fortunate. And the lab I had joined to work as a research, you know, technician was an aging lab. And this lab used a research model, a worm, a round nematode worm called C. elegans, which has a very short lifespan, around 2 weeks. And we did a variety of different manipulations genetically, diet-wise, other stress, environmental stressors on these worms, and it would change their lifespan. And I became very interested in that. At that point, I was like, biology is super cool. I want to pursue this at a higher level. And so I decided I wanted to go to graduate school, get a PhD. I started then becoming interested in cancer, specifically was interested in pediatric cancer. So I went to St. Jude Children's Research Hospital to do my graduate research. And I was, you know, I just had a very good mentor who, looking back on it, I can see how phenomenal he was because, you know, he was very hands-on and he gave me so much instruction, which is really what I needed. At the time, I was like, leave me alone. You know, I need to do what I want to do. But I'm actually glad that I got all the instruction and kind of like micromanagement, as people like to call it, that I got, because I feel like as a graduate student, really what you need to learn are the tools that are available to you to be able to answer very interesting biological questions. And I feel like I got that training, I did research in cancer, cancer metabolism, mitochondrial metabolism, apoptosis. And then from there, I started to get really interested in nutrition because I wanted to be able to have the best lifestyle, the best diet that I could to age the best way that I could. And so I started to get very interested in nutrition and in Bruce Ames' work, who was my postdoctoral mentor at the Children's Hospital, Oakland Research Institute in Oakland. And so I did a postdoc with him going on 3 years now. So, you know, and that's been a very, very pleasant and good experience. He's influenced a lot of my work. And from there, I just, you know, I'm still interested in a million different things that have to do with diet and lifestyle and, you know, genes and, you know, gut microbiome and epigenetics and just all over the place.
Well, and it all ties together, though. So we'll talk a little bit more about that in the podcast. Specifically, you're known for your work in nutrigenomics. Can you tell us a little bit more about what nutrigenomics entails?
Yeah. So nutrigenomics is a term that explains a very complex interaction between nutrients, micronutrients like vitamins and minerals, amino acids, essential fatty acids, macronutrients like fat, and the interaction between these nutrients and micronutrients that we're putting into our body with certain genes that we have. And in addition to that, it's also interactions between other compounds like xenobiotics, which are foreign to our body, and those interactions with our genes in our body. So everyone has, you know, we have the same genes. Humans have the same genes, but we have different variations of these genes. We have alternative forms of these genes. And the reason we have alternative forms of these genes is, well, I guess the reason's not really known. It's kind of theorized, and a lot of scientists think that, you know, the reason why we have alternative forms of genes, and when I say alternative forms, just a single nucleotide change in the DNA sequence in a gene can alter its function in a certain way. It's thought that many of these gene polymorphisms have arose from the fact that we lived in certain regions in the world that had certain food sources that were available to us, certain, you know, other types of environmental stressors that were there that weren't present in other regions in the world. So, for example, if you're living in a region where the selenium in the soil is very high, you may have a gene polymorphism that makes you not absorb selenium as well because you're getting so much of it. Whereas other populations of people that live somewhere where the selenium is not very high in the soil may have one that makes you absorb more of it. And there's like many, many different examples of this, but it's thought that's possibly so. Possibly nutrition and our environment may have actually shaped and allowed us to develop these different changes in the DNA sequence that changes the function in a gene that helps us adapt to our environment.
So essentially genes are selected for or kind of selected out based off of our nutritional environment.
Yeah, in theory. I think that makes sense. And, you know, I think that if you look really hard at any gene polymorphism, even ones that change the function in what would be considered a negative way, you can probably find a benefit. You can probably say, well, even though what we're seeing is a predominantly bad effect here, it also does this other good thing. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's kind of like, well, that's probably why it still exists in the population.
ApoE is an example, so.
Yeah, exactly, which is probably one of the most common gene polymorphisms that's known.
STEM Talk is an educational service of the Florida Institute for Human and Machine Cognition, a not-for-profit research lab pioneering groundbreaking technologies aimed at leveraging and extending human cognition, perception, locomotion, and resilience.
So what kind of gene polymorphisms, which genes are relevant when it comes to nutrition then, especially in our current population or our current makeup?
Wow, there's hundreds and hundreds of them. So
go to Walmart's and you'll see epigenetics at work.
So there's hundreds of different genes that are interacting with the micronutrients that we take in, with macronutrients that we take in. So I think one you know common one that most people are aware of are mostly because, you know, it can affect up to 50%. Half of the population has one form or another of a polymorphism in a gene that changes the way your body metabolizes folate. and, well, specifically, and also folic acid, which is the oxidized form of folate, which is found in a lot of vitamin pills. And, you know, folate is very important for two biological processes in the body. It's important to make new DNA. So it's important for thymine, which is a DNA nucleotide, and you need folate in order to make this. So anytime you're making a new cell in your body, whether that's a skin cell or a gut cell or a liver cell, you need to have folate to give yourself the precursor to make new DNA. It's very important, right? But folate also is very important to make precursors to epigenetics, which is a little different from nutrigenomics, because epigenetics refers to changing the amount of a gene that's produced to either make more of it, so it's more active, doing what it's, you know, whatever its function is more readily, or you make less of it. So even though the gene is there, it's almost as if it's not there because it's not doing its function.
So essentially it's affecting the gene's expression.
Exactly. And that's what that really means, gene expression. A lot of non-scientists don't really understand what that means. And essentially it's just talking about how much of the gene's being produced. So folate's important to make precursors called methyl groups, which are playing a very important role in epigenetics. So people have a polymorphism where they can't make the methyl group. So they can make the DNA precursor just fine, but they can't make the methyl group. And this gene is called the MTHFR gene. So some people that have this polymorphism actually do better when they take a dietary supplement called 5-methylfolate, because it bypasses that gene dysfunction and allows them to make 5-methylfolate, which is then used as a precursor to make methyl groups for epigenetics, to recycle homocysteine into methionine, for a variety of different biological processes. So I think that's one that's really well known. But I'm also very interested in a variety of other gene polymorphisms. There's another one that's in a gene called TRPM6, which is a transporter for magnesium. So dietary magnesium is very important. Magnesium is an essential micronutrient that's required in over 300 different enzymes in the body. The enzymes that make and use ATP, which is the energetic currency of the cell, need it. Enzymes that repair damage to your DNA need magnesium to function. And also enzymes in the brain that are important for making new neuronal connections need magnesium. So it's really important. And people have a gene polymorphism in this gene that does not allow them to transport magnesium outside of the cell into the cell very good. And it's been shown that individuals, and this is a cluster of polymorphisms in the TRPM6 gene, individuals with this polymorphism have a twofold higher risk of type 2 diabetes if they have a magnesium intake lower than 250 milligrams a day. 45% of the population does not meet the RDA for magnesium in the United States, which is around 350 to 400 milligrams a day, depending on if you're male or female. So you take that coupled with a high refined carbohydrate, high sugar diet, and it's like a ticking time bomb for type 2 diabetes. So that's, you know, another example of a very interesting and unique micronutrient gene interaction. I'm also interested in macronutrient gene interactions, the PPAR gamma, for example, which is very important for how your body metabolizes certain types of fat. And also I'm interested in how your body can inactivate certain xenobiotics that can become carcinogenic. So people, our bodies are beautifully designed to handle all sorts of types of stress. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so, but we have to be able to handle it. Our genes have to be working to be able to handle those stress. We have to give our genes the right nutrients to be able to make sure they're having the right cofactors, which are important for them to function. But certain people do have polymorphisms in genes, like NAT2, for example, where they're not able to inactivate heterocyclic amines as well, which can be carcinogenic. So, you know, there's a lot of different interactions between our diet, our lifestyle, and these gene polymorphisms, which make us all different. You know, gene polymorphisms make us members of a group. Those of us that have brown hair, brown eyes, blue eyes, blonde hair. So they regulate our phenotype, but they also regulate our disease risk, and they also regulate what types of foods and how much of those foods we should probably be focusing on getting or avoiding.
So what's interesting, so it's all really interesting to see the interplay there. So, you know, we see a lot of studies are published every day, you know, different studies on different diet approaches or supplements, and we see that often these studies fail in showing that these supplements or dietary approaches work. And this is usually they're applied to a general population. So do you think that there's probably, it sounds like there's probably a genetic a reason behind why, you know, there are these differences in individuals and you're not seeing significant effects across the general population.
Dawn, you just nailed it in my mind. That's exactly. I think that so the clinical trials in nutrition are enormously complicated and expensive, and they're not really done properly for those reasons, mostly the expensive part. It's very hard to fund them. You need a lot of funding to do them correctly. And because we are all different and we respond differently to, you know, different treatments, for example, vitamin D, there's a common gene polymorphism that does not allow us to convert vitamin D3 into the active steroid hormone, which vitamin D becomes. And people with this polymorphism do not do that very well. And the gene is the CYP2R1, which converts D3 into 25-hydroxy vitamin D in the liver. And so if you have a clinical trial and you're giving people a vitamin D supplement and you do not measure blood levels of vitamin D for one, you won't know. So if you're giving, it's known that around 1,000 IUs of vitamin D raises blood levels of vitamin D in normal people that don't have this gene polymorphism by 5 nanograms per milliliter. So if you're giving a population of people a vitamin D supplement that's, let's say it's 1,000 IUs of vitamin D, which is higher than what most studies do, but let's say in theory it is, and in some people it's not raising their blood levels at all, but you don't know that because you don't measure it, and then you have an outcome that's negative and you say, oh, vitamin D has no effect on X, Y, or Z. But we don't really know because we don't know, for one, if that raised their vitamin D levels to an adequate level. We don't know how vitamin D they were, you know, deficient they were to start with. Also, to kind of hit on this study, I mentioned the heterocyclic amines. Well, those are formed when you cook meat. It doesn't matter what kind of meat it is, chicken, fish, red meat, you know, meat, anything that's made of protein. When you cook them at a really, really high temperature, like frying or barbecue grilling them. And there's been many, many, many epidemiological studies that have been very conflicting, saying, oh, eating meat, and, you know, linked to increased cancer incidence. No, it's not. No, yes, it is. But there's a gene polymorphism. So cooking meat at the high temperature forms heterocyclic amines, which are carcinogenic. That's been shown in several different mouse studies and has been linked in human studies as well. But people have, and this is very common, I've seen multiple people's DNA that have this, a gene polymorphism where they're not able to inactivate them as fast. And so the more often you eat meat that's fried or barbecued, you know, when heat touches the protein itself, then...
Excuse me, I'm so sorry. I've got the remnants of a cold. Sorry, I apologize.
The whole concept of the meat was freaking me out. Yeah.
Well, Ken thought I was going to throw up everywhere. Yeah. I'm vegetarian, so, okay, so. Yeah. No, that's not it. I have
that's hilarious. Well, my point is that most people can inactivate this because they have this gene functioning. But if they don't, if they have this gene polymorphism and they're eating it all the time, they're going to have more buildup of the heterocyclic amines, which can then form a carcinogen. But if we had looked at people's genetics, in addition to looking at their meat consumption, I think we'll start to separate out and go, oh, look, it's those population of people with that certain polymorphism in this gene that are more susceptible to eating to getting cancer when they eat cooked meat, like, you know, all the time. And as I think, as these genetic tools become cheaper, as they become more available to consumers, I think that these studies will start to be done correctly. But I do think that you nailed it on why nutritional studies are so confusing and why there's so much conflicting data out there. And there's multiple reasons for it. And one of the reasons has to do with the fact that there is a very complex interaction between genes and diet.
Yeah. Yeah. And do you see nutrigenomics being incorporated into standard care in the very near future? It sounds like, I mean, it's so important, and it just seems obvious, you know, that we should be incorporating this kind of information into, you know, everybody talks about precision medicine. So do you see nutrigenomics being incorporated into just standard healthcare?
Absolutely. I think that it absolutely, you know, I think that more and more physicians are becoming aware of it. You know, I as a scientist have become aware of it and very interested in it. There are consumer tools out there like 23andMe that allow you to test, you know, thousands of different gene polymorphisms, and other tools out there like Promethease, which are, you know, can interpret some of these gene polymorphisms for people, tell you what they mean. I'm also developing a tool that I'm going to release soon that'll allow people to export their 23andMe data. So as consumers, as people, the public becomes more aware of nutrigenomics and starts to understand what their genes mean, I think that physicians are probably also going to, you know, because for one, if you have your patient coming in knowing more about it, that's probably a sign that you should probably get on top of things. But I do know several physicians are going to be, you know, are getting more and more interested in it. And it really is, it's an important thing to consider because we all are different. You know, we're all different. And the way my genes interact with certain nutrients are different than the way yours do. And that's just a fact. So we really need to understand that interaction and start to apply, you know, the knowledge that we're gleaming from that interaction and go on from there.
You are listening to STEM Talk, an educational service of the Florida Institute for Human and Machine Cognition.
And so I'm going to make the assumption, since you said you got into this area of research in the first place because you were interested in your own longevity and nutrition and health, you apply what you're learning as you go to your own daily activities and your own daily life?
I do. Yeah. So I've had my DNA polymorphisms sequenced by 23andMe, and I've had all my family members, immediate family members, and my distant family members, and I'm looking at everyone's genes, and I'm trying to find, you know, there's certain things some people don't want to know, and some people, you know, I think they don't want to know because they don't realize, well, knowing means you can actually design a lifestyle and diet that's a little more compatible with your genes. And so I think that fear of, oh, I have an increased risk for Alzheimer's disease, I don't want to know that. But in reality, you should know that because we know there are many different lifestyle factors that affect Alzheimer's disease risk in all people, you know, irrespective of your genotype. So I do apply what I've been learning, what I'm interested in my own life. And I have, you know, there's certain supplements that I take and, you know, things that I avoid, foods that I avoid, for example, avoid eating as often as other people who don't have those gene polymorphisms do.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. So you previously talked about epigenetics and nutrition. Can we go back to that? And can we just talk a little bit more about the role of epigenetics and the role of nutrition and how it affects epigenetic signatures in humans?
Yeah, it's certainly a very fascinating field. I've been interested in it for 7-8 years now, you know, just reading about it. You know, I've always been a very avid consumer of the scientific literature, broad spectrum. I'm just interested in all sorts of different fields. And I've been keeping up with the epigenetic field, even though I don't personally do research on it. I've been keeping up with other people's research in the field. And I think it's extremely interesting how your diet, how your lifestyle, how much stress you're under can alter, as we were talking about earlier, the expression of your genes or how much of a gene product you're making and how that actually can occur in sperm DNA or in the egg DNA and be passed on to your children or your grandchildren.
Yeah, so I think that's most interesting. That's really interesting because people don't think about their daily actions impacting, you know, the lives and the longevity or the health of their offspring. They don't think about that.
Exactly. The offspring they haven't had. I mean, they don't think about the fact that it's like, well, okay, their DNA, you know, they've got half of your DNA. They're going to have half of your DNA and half of your spouse's DNA. But what they don't realize is that that DNA that you have, that template you're starting with, can actually be altered. That's very interesting. And there's a study that was published a few years ago that caught my interest. This was a group out of Australia where male mice, and male mice are really interesting because whenever you use female mice, there's always the confounding factor of, oh, it's the environment, the pregnancy, there's something going on in the environment,
hormones,
right?
And yeah.
Yeah, there's, you can always sort of make that argument. Whereas when the changes occur in the sperm DNA in something that's not carrying the fetus, then it's hard to say it's the you know, environment, you know, the uterine environment. So these researchers in Australia fed male mice a diet that's highly inflammatory, very high in corn oil, sugar, and lard as well. And these male mice became obese. big surprise. They also, you know, became insulin resistant. I mean, that's not a surprise. That's been known for decades, right? But what was surprising is that they had female offspring that were fed a normal diet, normal chow, you know, normal amount of fats and sugars and fiber. The female mice were lean. They did not become obese. However, they developed type 1 diabetes. Why did they develop type 1 diabetes? Well, mechanistically, which was so nice about this paper, which was published in Nature, is that these Australian researchers showed that what happened when the male mice had this terrible inflammatory diet, it caused methyl groups, which are an epigenetic mark, to sit on top of a gene that regulates pancreatic islet insulin production and silence it. And it was, this happened in the sperm DNA, and it was passed on to the offspring. And so even though those female mice had the gene, it wasn't working. It just wasn't making insulin. So they became type 1 diabetic. And then you know, so this is, like I said, a few years ago. Many different studies have been published since then. Just recently, earlier this month, in the Journal of Cell Metabolism, a paper that was very, very provocative was published because it demonstrates that something like this may be occurring in humans. So the study, it was a small study, but essentially the study had taken overweight and obese males and gotten a sample of their sperm DNA. And it looked at their epigenetic signature. So it looked at their methylome, all the methyl groups in their DNA, and compared it to lean males. And they found that there was changes in the methylome, so these epigenetic marks were different in over 9,000 genes between the overweight obese and the lean men. These overweight obese men then underwent bariatric surgery, which is a pretty dramatic surgical procedure, and they lost a ton of weight. Sperm samples were taken 1 week later after the surgery and 1 year after the surgery. And what was found was that changes in the sperm DNA, epigenetic signature of the sperm DNA, after 1 week, changed in over 1,500 genes, and after a year, over 3,000 genes changed, and they began to look like the lean males. So the signature started to look more like what the lean males were. And we're talking about changes in genes involved in regulating metabolism, fat metabolism, you know, hunger hormones, brain function. So very interesting and provocative study suggesting that it seems as though at least weight loss can affect the sperm methylome.
So essentially the epigenetic, I hate saying damage, but the changes that are epigenetic changes that are induced by bad choices that we make can essentially be reversed if we choose a healthier lifestyle.
Exactly. And I think that's sort of the take home, where I think there's two take homes. One, on the opposite end of the spectrum, our bad diets, not only are we increasing our type 2 diabetes risk, our cardiovascular disease risk. You know, you may not care about yourself, but you're also affecting your offspring, your children that you haven't had yet. And you can make a change if you're obese, if you're overweight, if you're eating a terrible diet. It's not too late.
Yeah, and as we get older too, our epigenetic signature changes, correct?
Absolutely.
So I remember reading, and I remember even hearing a talk that you gave about epigenetic kind of biomarkers of aging. Can you tell us a little bit more about that, and then how nutrition could potentially impact that or even reverse some of those changes?
Yeah, so this was also study out of Steve Horwitz's lab. I think he's at UCLA. And he's been doing a lot of research on looking at these epigenetic signatures in a variety of different cell types in humans of various different ages, ranging from very young to 100 years old. And what he has uncovered is that there are unique signatures that seem to happen or seem to occur at different ages. And they're so unique that researchers can actually look at, for example, a blood cell from someone and guess their age within a few years, plus or minus a few years,
wow,
which is pretty incredible.
Yeah.
You know,
I can't think of anything else out there
like
that.
Can you imagine someone just giving you a blood sample and you going, okay, this, looking at their methylome and going, oh, this person is about 55 years old.
It's like counting the rings in a tree trunk.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And so, and this is very interesting because in addition to that, there were other disease states that also were looked at. For example, cancer. So tissue from tumors was looked at. And what was interesting is that these tissues that were cancerous looked like an older epigenetic signature. So they looked like they had accelerated aging by like 40% or something crazy. So, you know, there are things in our environment that, you know, are changing our epigenetic signatures. And we know that these epigenetic signatures are modulated by diet, by lifestyle. And many of these genes that had been changed with age were genes that control repairing damage to DNA, genes that control metabolism, genes that control degrading proteins after they've been aggregated and can clump around and do bad things. So they're, you know, genes are important for making new stem cells, genes that are important for clearing away damaged cells. I mean, everything that you can imagine would be important to age well. Those genes are being changed by epigenetic marks. And we do know that certain lifestyle and dietary factors can positively affect those very genes, right? So I mentioned earlier magnesium. Magnesium's at the center of a chlorophyll molecule, which means it's found, which give plants a green color, and which means it's found in green vegetables. You know, so magnesium's required for DNA repair enzymes. You know, if you eat more magnesium, you're going to have more of those DNA repair enzymes that are getting the magnesium. You know, now in terms of what epigenetically to do in the diet, in our diet, in our lifestyle, we don't really know exactly, but we do know things like exercise. We know things like sleep. We know things like eating a good diet that's, you know, high in micronutrients and, you know, low in refined carbohydrates. Things like that are really good for us. Low stress. And most likely, I think we'll begin to find that is happening at the multiple levels, but one level would be at the epigenetic level. And I think that more and more scientists are beginning to investigate this, and we'll be able to tease it apart.
That's interesting, because all the things that you mentioned are all things that have been implicated in improving longevity. And I know that you've done some research in longevity, kind of moving away from epigenetics now, and looking at the benefits of sauna. Can you talk about some of your research in that area?
Yeah. So the research I've been doing with the sauna has not been experimental. It's been me sort of reading everyone else's data they've sort of dumped out into, you know, the interwebs and putting things together just based on some of my knowledge of heat shocking. So heat shock is a type of stress. And when you get in the sauna, you're heat shocking. You know, when you're in the middle of the blazing Ocala summer, you know, and it's 95 degrees out with 70% humidity or whatever, you know, that's heat shocking. You know, there's a variety of ways to heat shock the body. When you're exercising vigorously and your core body temperature is elevated, that's heat shocking. And what scientists have shown, and in fact, I've been involved in some of this work in my early career with nematodes and worms, is that when you heat shock an organism, you actually activate a variety of genes that are involved in stress resistance. So you activate genes that are important to make sure proteins don't clump together and aggregate and make sure they're getting degraded properly. You activate genes like FOXO3, which is considered a longevity gene because it activates many, many different genes involved in aging. So heat shock activates that. In and of itself, one of the master genes that it regulates is called heat shock factor 1, and that's been linked to longevity in humans as well. So the heat stress itself is a type of stress. It's a good type of stress, and it's often called hormetic stress because hormesis means you're giving your body a little bit of stress, not too much, but a little bit of stress to activate all the good genes in your body to deal with stress. So I think that a lot of the benefits from exercise, there are many, many different benefits, many cardiovascular benefits and things like that. But I think that some of the benefits from exercise also may come from the heat shocking of the body, you know, increasing that core body temperature, which can also be done with the sauna. And recently, a study out of Finland showed that so there was a dose-dependent effect of sauna use and all-cause mortality. And men that use the sauna more frequently had a lower all-cause mortality. So I forget the exact statistics, but men that used it like 4 to 7 times a week had a 40% lower all-cause mortality, meaning they died less of cancer, or neurodegenerative disease, cardiovascular disease, all types of non-accidental, you know, deaths. And that's obviously epidemiology. But like I said, if we go into mouse and flies and worms, it's been shown that even just a single heat shock in these animals can increase their lifespan. In the case of worms and flies, it can increase their lifespan by 15 to 20%, which is kind of cool. You know, so there's I am interested in these different types of hormetic stress and exercise and sauna and cold shock in the body and what effects those have on gene expression and what types of genes they're affecting and how that plays a role with the way we age.
So there are lots of people here who are interested in neuroplasticity. Does sauna have an effect on neuroplasticity?
Well, heat stress actually does increase something in the brain called brain-derived neurotrophic factor. And brain-derived neurotrophic factor is very important for not only growing new neurons in the brain, keeping the neurons there already live, but it's also very important for strengthening the connection between the neurons. So the synapses that are formed between the neurons, which is essentially how the neurons are communicating with each other. And so it plays a very important role in long-term potentiation and neuroplasticity and being able to strengthen that connection between the two neurons. So that's – and what's interesting is that exercise and sauna together actually have a synergistic effect. So going in the sauna after your workout may actually have a really positive effect on your brain.
Interesting.
Agreed. Before she got here, we were talking about sauna and how it was super popular – like 40 years ago, especially with people like wrestlers or boxers who take a lot of head blows and body damage. And you would literally sit in the sauna partly because you didn't want to run to elevate your heartbeat because you were beat up.
Right.
So you would use the sauna to elevate your heart rate. And partly for – we didn't know the science, but to, it seemed like it helped with recovery, you know, with healing.
It actually, it does help because the heat shock proteins, when you activate them, they actually, when you activate them before any sort of trauma, there's a protective effect because there's all sorts of pathways. There are, you know, glutathione recycling, all sorts of antioxidant things going on. But yeah, they're in gyms for a reason. They're in gyms for, I mean, you go to any, almost any gym, there's always a sauna there. Yeah. Why?
Usually the lawyers have it turned down. So far that you get no benefit almost.
Right, yeah.
So the lawyers, why is that?
Well, the lawyers are in charge of the temperature because they want to have it so that you couldn't possibly hurt yourself.
Oh, okay.
So instead of being like 180 or something, you know, it's like 135.
The one at the YMCA is 115 or something like that. It's like, that's not even, you might as well just go outside in Florida. You could just walk outside and it'd be hotter than that. So, yeah.
I don't always listen to podcasts, but when I do, I listen to STEM Talk, interviewing the most interesting people in the world of science and technology. Stay curious, my friends.
So you've done some of your previous research has been focused on vitamin D, so we know that's important in just overall health, but can you specifically talk to the role that it plays in both brain development and also in cognitive function? That's very relevant to work that is being done at IHMC.
Yeah, so vitamin D is converted into a steroid hormone that actually regulates about approximately 5% of all the protein-encoded genes in the body. So I can't tell you precisely how it's regulating cognitive function and brain development because it's probably doing it by a variety of different mechanisms. But what I can tell you is some of the research that I have done with my mentor, Dr. Bruce Ames, who has been a phenomenal mentor and has to do with the fact that I found that vitamin D is able to regulate one of the genes that is important for converting, actually the gene that makes an enzyme that's the rate-limiting enzyme for the conversion of tryptophan into serotonin, and this happens in the brain. Well, vitamin D, there's a little telltale sequence in that gene that I found that's consistent with activation. And when vitamin D binds to the vitamin D receptor, it translocates into the nucleus and binds to that DNA and turns it on. And so I published a paper initially on this in 2014, where I talk about how vitamin D is very important for making serotonin in the brain and why that's very important for early brain development, because serotonin during early brain development is actually a brain morphogen, which means that it acts as a signaling molecule during fetal brain development to shape the structure and the wiring of the brain. So it's very important for guiding neurons to get to the right place. And once they get to the right place, it's very important for making sure they become the right type of neuron. And this has been shown experimentally in many different studies where serotonin is depleted, both genetically, pharmacologically. It disrupts brain development. It leads to autistic-like behaviors. And so in my paper, actually, I relate this to autism because, you know, vitamin D may be linked to activating this gene in early brain development so that you can make serotonin. What's really interesting is that the developing fetus depends entirely on the maternal levels of vitamin D. So if the developing fetus is not getting enough vitamin D to activate that gene to convert tryptophan into serotonin, it's possible that not enough serotonin is being made, and therefore brain development may be abnormal or altered. And since I published this paper, an independent group in Arizona, the University of Arizona, has biochemically, very beautifully biochemically validated that indeed vitamin D does activate tryptophan hydroxylase 2 mRNA in multiple different neuronal types, which was really nice because it does sort of validate some of my work. But, you know, most people think of serotonin as being a neurotransmitter that's important for mood. And in fact, it does so much more. And, you know, not only during brain development, like I said, it's important for shaping the structure and wiring of the brain, but in people that are already developed, so adults, it plays a very important role in behavior, in impulse control, in long-term thinking and planning, in mood, in memory. And so, and this has been shown experimentally. You can actually deplete people of their serotonin by giving them a big shake of branched chain amino acids like leucine and isoleucine, because tryptophan, which has to get into the brain in order to be converted into serotonin, serotonin made it in the gut. It's also made in the gut. I'm not going to go into that right now, but it does not cross over the blood-brain barrier. So the serotonin in the brain has to be made there, and tryptophan has to get in there to make it. Well, the transporter that allows tryptophan to get there also transports leucine and isoleucine and other branched chain amino acids, but it gets outcompeted. Those get in first. So, which is why, by the way, exercise, when you exercise, you actually, branched chain amino acids are taken up into your muscle cell to build muscle. You alleviate that competition. You get tryptophan in your brain, making more serotonin. It's part of the reason why, in addition to endorphins, you feel really good after you exercise. But aside from that, the point I was getting is you give someone a shake of branched chain amino acids, it outcompetes all their tryptophan. And within a few hours, 90% of their brain serotonin is depleted. Normal people become very impulsive. Their long-term thinking shuts down. They become depressive. Their sensory gating is affected, so their ability to censor out different extraneous motor or visual stimuli, auditory stimuli, they get overloaded and overwhelmed. So serotonin is regulating a lot of brain functions and behaviors in addition to just mood. And what I think is very, very important to emphasize, to bring it back to the nutrigenomics, is that many different people have gene polymorphisms in serotonin-related genes. I'm one of them. I have one in my tryptophan hydroxylase 2 gene that makes me not make serotonin as well. My mother has one in her serotonin transporter. I've looked at many people's DNA to see. I mean, it's very, very common. These gene polymorphisms have been linked to autism and other, you know, mood disorders and things like that. And I think that people that are already genetically predisposed to low serotonin, in addition to that, if they're not getting the nutritional input, for example, vitamin D, they're also deficient in vitamin D, it's like a double whammy. So their serotonin production is just, it's just not optimal genetically, and they're not getting that activation that they need from that hormone that regulates 1,000 different genes in the body. So I think that's a very important thing to realize, is that there is probably a very complex interaction, and it's possible that this complex interaction between vitamin D and serotonin may make a huge difference in people's lives that are vitamin D deficient.
Very interesting. Yeah. I didn't know all that, actually.
Yeah, that's good stuff. Are you aware of there's a little bit of an argument going on in sort of the athletic world between those who see no advantage to supplementing with all the essential amino acids, the EAAs, as opposed to BCAAs?
You know, I'm not aware of the argument. I mean, BCAAs obviously are very important for growing muscle, and those guys all want to bulk up, right?
But the BCAAs are all included in the EAAs.
Oh, are they?
Yeah. So all, you know, all of the essential amino acids include the isoleucine, leucine.
Right.
So the argument is whether you get anything, I think it actually plays into your hands. The argument is, do you get anything, is there any benefit of having the complete set of amino acids? The essential amino acids is the supplement, because mm-hmm. these would include tryptophan, these would include the whole set.
Right.
Rather than just hammering leucine and valine, isoleucine.
Well, it seems like there would be a benefit.
I think it plays to your story, actually.
Yeah.
So. That, there's a row about that.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with it. I'd have to read up on it. But that is interesting, because you would want more tryptophan.
Yeah. So you can guess which camp I'm in.
Yeah.
Okay, so Dr. Patrick, thank you so much for joining us today on our podcast.
My pleasure, Dawn. Thanks for having me. Very interesting conversation. I'm really glad I got to talk with you.
STEM Talk.
Yeah, so that was a very interesting interview with Dr. Rhonda Patrick. She covered a wide variety of topics and did a great job of explaining some of these relatively complex concepts.
Absolutely. Everything from genetics to sauna to micronutrients, She did a wonderful job.
And as mentioned in the intro, you can find more information from Dr. Rhonda Patrick at her blog, foundmyfitness.com.
Links to her podcast and lectures will be in the show notes.
Thank you for listening to STEM Talk. We want this podcast to be discovered by others. So please take a minute to go to iTunes to rate the podcast and perhaps even write a review. More information about this and other episodes can be found at our website, stemtalk.us. There, you can also find more information about the guests we interview.